we're ready to move on to the next paper. And this is Anne Stanfield Haggart. And she has appeared at ARS before. She was during the Sheet Music Conference at the Ward Irish Museum in Milwaukee. She is a singer, and in fact, she was vocalist for the Picayune Cabaret Band, and she has also appeared as an actress, and she has also provided immigrant and low-income children with arts enrichment groups organized at community centers, offered for children from 4 to 12. These groups took current problems in American culture and assisted the children as they use performing arts to address these issues and share their perceptions and dilemmas. The name of her paper is Substance Abuse as Reflected in American Popular Music from 1880 to 1930. Would you please welcome Anne Stanfield Haggart.
Thank you. I'm not a collector, and I'm not a presenter of archival work, but what I do is use old music and vintage sheet music and recordings and song to educate about what was happening in America a long time ago. Usually go about 1850, 1830 to 1930. And I've done this with children, I've done this in other countries, and I like to find ways to use this wonderful old material to educate people and to get them thinking about the things that have continued on to this day.
A preachment, dear friends, you're about to receive on John Barleycorn, nicotine, and the temptations of Eve.
Okay, that's it. It was so good.
Once I was happy and had a good wife. I had enough money to last me for life. I met with a gal and we went on a spree. She taught me to smoke and drink whiskey,
cigarettes and whiskey and wild, wild women. And drive you crazy, they'll drive you insane.
Nobody sang along. This was a presentation that I've done for music educators, and as a social worker, I also use it to look at addictions. And this is one of the progressions that I will show you in the sheet music in terms of some of the labels. Really, what I'm talking about is the tremendous changes that occurred in America around the time and after the Civil War. Incredible urbanization, railroads allowing people to travel from south to north, from east to west, towns began to form, commercialism took off, there was more ways to communicate, advertising changed, the roles of women changed, and people were having to mix with whole different groups that weren't their family or weren't something that they were familiar with. So what I've done is to start out looking at all different ways that somebody might use any substance. Habit. You're getting to be a habit with me. So what's a habit? A habit is something you like to do. It can be innocent. It doesn't have to be oppressive. It's something you like to do. Indulgence. I know you sheet music collectors are after this piece, right? Here's an indulgence. A beer, a sandwich, and you. One of the things that began to happen is stimulants. Here's another indulgence. Not only, again, tea for two, but also a relationship. Now we move to overindulgence. Ugh. Overindulgence is when there's too much of something. Too much, and too much is proof that you can get it, that you are powerful. And it's also wonderful to not care about overindulgence, to be allowed to enjoy it and flaunt it. I'm on a diet of love. You can have more than your share. Very important in terms of indulgence. Here we have a young Will Rogers, a young Janet Gaynor. Those are the only two I recognize. Some the others of you may know people. Next, we move to Temptation. You'll notice her hair is down, 1909. She's not a prim Gibson girl, and she's a redhead, the possibility that she's Irish. And she's tempting, the notion of excitement, and that it's not your fault. Something outside of you caused this to happen. You were tempted. Plus, it's a sin, but again, it wasn't your fault. Here were the theories in 1870 and before about what would be going on if somebody was imbibing and tempted too much. Well, before that, one was weak-willed. One was a little faint of heart and didn't have what was necessary in terms of values. After that became the concept of inebriety, a disease triggered by underlying mental disturbance. So anybody who was overusing any substance, alcohol and drugs or food, actually had an underlying disturbance. Here was a wonderful theory used in a number of malicious ways, the theory of degeneration, that moral deviation can be transmitted hereditarily. Remember the Jukes and the Kallikaks? Anybody in that family? So there was a progressive deterioration. It wasn't the children's fault. You see, the father, or maybe the mother was nervous, grandmother was nervous, dad was neurotic. It's not your fault you're psychotic, that your children are idiotic, because it will all die out in the next one. Combine this with racism and xenophobia regarding immigrants coming in, and you saw how important it was to maintain boundaries of what was familiar. Here was the neurosis theory, very popular, that you had an inadequate nervous system. Now, this particular, Dr. Beard was very, very worried about the brain workers, which I think are us. Entrepreneurs and others who were caught up in a hectic pace and were prey to a neurotic tendency to seek relief. And that would lead to pathological impressions. That was addiction. So again, it's a little unclear whose fault it is. They probably were just caught up and their neurotic tendency came out and then they were addicted. One of the things I wanted to say about the last one, sorry, was that as you can see, the notion here is that you are to calm down, that you can't help it, that this swirl of changes that were occurring in your society, in your neighborhood, who your children were playing with that were from other races or other areas, you needed to calm down. It was an important, necessary thing. Well, here's the opposite. Stimulants. There's one theory that stimulants began to be necessary around this time due to the Industrial Revolution. We needed to keep people up. We needed to keep them awake because now they were working in towns and factories. They weren't just on the farm. They had little bureaucratic things they were to do. The electric lights made it possible for people to stay up later. Electric fans meant that people could work in worse situations. So stimulation is the key. What you notice here, which was what Tony pointed out to me, my husband, is that in fact, you are as the cream, provide a way to imbibe the necessity. So that he's saying, you are the cream in my coffee. I'm drinking coffee to rev myself up, but you are the cream. You are there to counteract the stimulant. Oops, sorry. Well, we've now entered something else.
Say, did you ever meet that Reaper man?
No, I never met the guy. Tell me about it.
Oh, no, you're not kidding me now, are you? You never met the Reaper man? Oh, no, you never met the Reaper man? And yet you say you swim to China and you wanted to sell me South Carolina? I believe you know the Reaper Man. Say, did you ever meet that Reaper Man?
No, I never met
the
guy. Tell me about
him.
Oh, no, you're not kidding me now, are you? You never met the Reaper Man.
Sorry.
Did you ever meet that...
There. Okay, this isn't a record, but this is one of my favorite cartoonists, Winsor McCay, famous for Gertie the Dinosaur, Little Nemo, Dreams of a Rarebit Fiend. There's an addiction, Dreams of a Rarebit Fiend. These were published in the New York Herald in the 1920s, and McKay called them sermons on paper. Thought this was wonderful. Here's another one, Dope. The children, when they see this today, don't get it. They don't understand what that means. Here's a different kind of dope. Here's upper class, waspy sort of dope, possibly leading to crime, certainly possibly leading to gambling. He's got a book on dope, he's got a pipe, and he's drinking something. Here's another friend. This was actually a cleaned up version of a song called Take a Drink on Me. Other way around? Oh, thank you. Things could be blown in your nose, inhaled, ingested, injected, could be adulterated. It was a wonderful stimulant. The stevedores in New Orleans were given cocaine, and they could work for 70 hours loading or unloading the steamboats. Report? Nah. All right. I apologize, guys. Well, I would like to say this isn't Al's fault either. It's my fault. A lot of the songs made it hard to really identify which substance people were talking about. Some of that was done on purpose as a way to possibly hide what exact reference was being used. This was a song that I sang in the 60s as a folk singer, the Cocaine Blues. Here's a more fancy version of cocaine, Ethel Merman. The bootleg version said, I get no thrill from cocaine. Cocaine was really being imported most heavily in the 1880s and the 1890s. And in 1890, the most prevalent opium addict in America was a white woman who was given it by her physician. She could take paregoric or Scott's Oats medication, laudanum, Dover powders. It was used to sedate and ease pain. It was also finally used by a lot of prostitutes and was used here in New Orleans, Al Rose says, in Storyville, because one of the side effects of an overdose of opium is a cessation of menstruation, which meant it was a birth control device. Most of the women were considered opium eaters, not opium smokers. Opium smokers were more social than the eaters. They were more prone to be outside, and they would go to places called a joint, and that was where they would smoke their pipe. Here we get into, maybe we won't have an influence from England. I don't know what I'm doing here. Delete it, that's what I'll do. Here's different. Thank you. Here's some different sheet music. This is a very oriental looking Fred Astaire with Lucille Bremer going the way that the rest of them did. Here's another version of it, Limehouse Blues. Limehouse was a dock area in England where there were a lot of opium dens, supposedly run by Chinese. In fact, they were run by the Brits, but they liked to get the Chinese addicted. How it was seen mostly here in America is that the first opium smokers were the Chinese that came over in 1870. In fact, the 1882, the Chinese Exclusion Act, began to limit the number of Chinese that could be here. And by 1879, whites were beginning to inject opium. The hypodermic needle had been imported in 1857, and that became a really handy way to overdose or to take too much. Here's one of the most offensive sheet musics that we found in Tony's collection. Here we have the stereotype of the Irishman as the chimpanzee face. And he's a police officer, another Irish stereotype. And what he said is, I've come here, and of course I'm a drunk, and I'm in New York, and I have met a chink, and now I'm on dope. Offensive in about 10 different directions, a new first. Now we move to cigarettes. Lady Liberty, smoking a cigarette. Some more girls. You'll notice here that these women are not yet a flapper. You can't really tell if their hair has been cut. It's up, it's bobbed. And this is a song by Sigmund Romberg.
This heart of mine,
heart of mine,
that's in my breath,
that's in my
breath.
Yeah, we can turn, yeah. Here is my cigarette lady, who is now more of a flapper. You see her hair is cut. Words by Rudy Valley, Glenn Gray. Pipe smoking here. In fact, when opium was smoked in a pipe, the ash, they only got about 9% of the opium out of it, and the ash that developed in the bottom was called yen shi by the Chinese, and it could be that that was the beginning of the word to have a yen for something. Now, these girls are obvious flappers, and you'll notice that they have a rolling machine there, a cigarette rolling machine. And again, as Tony had pointed out, we're not sure if they're rolling a cigarette or tobacco or their stockings or their that nice man in the bar. Here's some advertising in tobacco. Pall Mall, 1907, you got a gift in every box. It was a little silk hanky, and the guys were, what you were supposed to do is buy all the silk hankies and give them to your girlfriend, and she would sew them together and make you a pillow. Poor Lydia Pinkham, you might have heard of her pills. Reach for a vegetable became reach for a smoke, not a sweet. What a wonderful way to lose weight. Edward Bernays was a PR pioneer here in New York City. He got all the Ziegfeld girls to sign a pledge saying that they would not smoke. And also, Arthur Murray came out with an announcement that heavy dancers took up too much space on the dance floor, so it would be better if they lost weight. As a mental health professional, what I love about this is that Edward Bernays is Sigmund Freud's nephew. His mother was Minna Bernays. Oh, and we know Sigmund Freud died of throat and tongue cancer from addiction. Smoke Dreams, The Waltz of Phi Gamma Delta. Not sure what he's smoking. Cigars. It was actually done in the northern states. The South was more into plug tobacco and chewing tobacco. One of the problems with cigars was that in the North they were made in sweatshops that were usually within homes, and that there was a lot of migrants who made cigars. Theodore Roosevelt, as a commissioner in New York, tried very hard to get sweatshops closed down. Here's a man that says smoking cigars is better than smoking cigarettes. Food and Dieting, from Munsey's Magazine. You'll notice that here is an electric massage roller that can turn your obese arms into slender, nice arms, and it doesn't require any hard work. See, she's rolling it on her face. I'm going to tell you about the Perfect 36. Perfect 36 was considered a woman's bust size. It was also considered attractive when the vertical distance between the eyes and the mouth were 36% of the face. Science. What Susan B. Anthony and a lot of the suffragettes used this because they needed 36 states to ratify women's vote. And when Tennessee became number 36, so the whole campaign there was become a perfect 36. And that meant that Tennessee could be the state that would ratify. Here's Trixie Fraganza. Trixie was a wonderful performer. Very, very early on, you see, she was very slender. But she, like many other performers, women performers more than men, found that as they got older and bulkier, what was very funny was to make fun of their weight and their size and to use that as a sort of almost becoming a red-hot mama. Trixie described herself as the perfect 46. And here are some of the other women that did very similar things. May Irwin, Marie Dressler, Sophie Tucker, Bessie Smith, Sally Mayhew. Sally Mayhew would sit down at the piano, this big, bulky woman, and she'd sit down, and then rather than move her chair to the piano, she would pull the piano towards her. Elsie Janis, the sweetheart of the expeditionary forces. I want to sing you a song that was sung that has to do with trying to lose weight. And when I sing this nowadays, a lot of the young people are struck by how similar it is, the same issues. Are you downhearted? Are you minus joy? Have you acquired too much avoirdupois? Don't worry, my friend. Your troubles are now at an end. Are you reducing? Have you tried this out? Oh, you know the system I'm talking about. When you're overweight, holy smokes, don't you hate to hear this bromide folks are flinging of late? Cheer up. Eat and grow thin, take up and shake up that whole double chin. Try it, diet, get on a diet. Take up long marches and cut out the starches as merrily you roll along over the hardwood floor. When your old 36 is just won't 36, and each eye that says yes, there's a hook that says nix. And to get in and out, you do Houdini tricks. When you're trying to eat and grow thin, breakfast finds your tummy hard to control. When you just have lemon juice and a roll across the floor for 10 or 12 minutes or more. You don't know how good to drink water feels till they cut out all your drinking at meals. When you hear glasses clink and you're trying to shrink, then you know why some folks commit murder for drink. Cheer up, eat and grow thin, wake up and shake up that whole double chin. Buy it, try it, get on a diet. Get some long glances, by hoop-de-hoop dances, as merrily you roll along over the parquet floor. For 6 months you diet while going the rounds. You lose 16 ounces and joy knows no bounds. Then you eat one potato and put on 3 pounds. When you're trying to eat and grow thin. When I do this with children, I have a whole thing about a hook and eye with advertisements of hook and eyes and what that means and avoir de poids and terms they don't know. Young Lawrence Welk. Here's another good one. Young Arthur Godfrey. Anyone want to sing it? Stand up. No. Huggin' and a Chalkin'. He would make a mark on the back of her back where his hand went. Touching, literally. Here's a song that goes through both. Nancy Fatt and My Polly Ann, 1864. It's not hard, I can't tell whether it was that she drank or that she was fat, but by Dave Reed. What good is your water when you're dry? Well, they found that tobacco dries out the mouth, and they had said that tobacco creates a morbid and diseased thirst that water does not take care of. There were lemonade societies born, and in fact, in the late 1800s, they would oftentimes destroy apple orchards to stop cider being made into alcohol. 1919, people are getting a little worried. We know why, what's coming. Prohibition's coming. This is during Prohibition. Here shows the positive aspects of alcohol, camaraderie, togetherness, just all the guys. Here's a vanity publication done by someone named James Francis Warren of a song that was close to his heart, the Blue Laws, Blues. Here's some Prohibition songs, all having to do with Prohibition blues. Everybody wants a key to my cellar. Or in Prohibition, you've lost your sting. I don't think we'll try to play it just because of my... Salvation Nell, this temperance movement, guaranteed to make everyone in the world feel guilty. Do you know this? Doesn't people know the term about do you serve buffaloes? I heard that this was a joke. People would go into, a man would go into a bar and say, you know, do you serve the elks? Do you serve the lions? Do you serve the buffaloes? And that's how they would get drinks. There's a PhD in there for someone. Celeste? Do your PhD on buffaloes. Buffalo songs. Here's a few things I found from New Orleans. My husband Tony has a large sheet music collection, and he, in fact, has brought some beautiful pictures of New Orleans if people want to see it. But these were just the ones that I found that could link up with substance abuse. The Growler's Waltz. I didn't know what a growler was. In fact, it's still a term used today for a small receptacle of... that you place in somewhere to get alcohol and get back. Published in New Orleans on Baronne Street. Huey Cannon and John Queen, local guys. What had happened was one guy offered another guy, his friend, a drink, and the guy got a 10-cent drink as opposed to a 5-cent drink, and that offended him. Here's another John Queen, Got Your Habits On. What this song is talking about is he's saying nobody drinks anymore. Everybody's just taking cocaine. It's no fun at all. wanted to end by talking a little bit about what's happened with substance abuse today. But if we look back over history, almost always there's been a stereotype and a targeting that alcohol and substance abuse is a great way to have fun. That if you're drunk or you're stoned, you must really be having fun because, look, you're really having fun. There was a sort of romanticization that is certainly used among young people or people who live on the fringe of society, like a lot of musicians did, was that somehow using substances was proof that you were out of the norm, that you were powerful, that you'd broken away from your parents, and that you were in the alternative lifestyle, or, as also been called, the deviant subculture of music. We know now that there's targeting subcultures that's gone on, the Virginia Slims that were targeted for women. There's particular cigarettes that were targeted for men, Marlboro men, and there were for African Americans. There's some confusion regarding whether addiction is, in fact, medical or biochemical. Obviously, the basis before was that you had to have a lot of willpower, and that now we have medicalized it to where it is a disorder that has symptoms and treatment. In fact, in 1975, I was working as a therapist in D.C., and at that point, no insurance company would pay for anybody to receive treatment for substance abuse. That you could only receive treatment if you were had a psychiatric problem. And the only reason that the insurance industry decided to approve to fund substance abuse is by an act of Congress, which was done in 1978. This is a wonderful song that's saying, what are you going to do if they take away jazz? What are you going to do if they take away syncopation? What are people going to do? How are they going to treat those weary blues everybody has? So I want to end there. I apologize for the technical problems and would be happy to hear anybody's favorite songs that have to do with any of these because I'm always looking for new examples. Thank you. Could have been, don't know, very likely. And certainly whoever needed it that would take it that way. In other words, there's always in the subculture this joke of sort of, haha, we know what it really means. But very possibly, yeah. The blurring of, that's what I mean, the blurring of the terms about what substances were being used was very important as a sign of craftiness. Chris. Well, I'm not sure of all of that, Chris. I do know that when things were starting to be banned.
Marijuana was outlawed after
mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah, and opium was, I think, 1911. There was an Opium Act of 1911. Sorry? Yes. It could be given, you could ingest it, but what people would do is crush the pills and sniff it. Right. But it depended on how it was done. And again, that was sort of racially and also socioculturally determined, who did what. I don't know, that's a good question, Chris. I should be clear on that. Thank you.
While we're changing the computers, I want to thank Anne Stanfield Haggard for her paper.